Welcome to a series of netcasts brought to you by Yale University.
Hello, and welcome to the Yale Law Journal podcast. I'm Aurelia Chaudhary.
And I'm Tyler Hill.
On this podcast, we interview authors from the Law Journal and bring their insights to the broader public. We're very excited to bring you our first episode, which covers federal sentencing policy.
Federal judges have wide latitude in setting criminal sentences. To assist them in the task, they use the Federal Sentencing Guidelines, a compendium of tables and formulas, to serve as a reference point. But what if they miscalculate? Does the defendant have a right to challenge the sentence on the grounds that there was a chance the judge would have set a lower sentence if she had calculated the guidelines reference point correctly?
Kate Huddleston, a 2L at the law school, is about to publish a comment on exactly this topic. Kate is not only a dear friend of mine, but also the reason that I passed Fed Courts last semester, so I'm especially excited that we get to talk to her today. Kate, do you want to take a moment to summarize your piece?
So in July 2010, a federal district court sentenced D'Angelo Whiteside to 17 years and 6 months in prison. And under then-existing Fourth Circuit precedent, Mr. Whiteside's two prior state drug convictions triggered the application of the Sentencing Guidelines Career Offender Enhancement to his recommended sentence. And the Career Offender Sentencing Enhancement is one of the harshest sentencing enhancements in the federal guidelines. In order to qualify, you need to have at least two prior felony convictions of crimes of violence or controlled substances offenses. And so the sentencing guidelines recommended between 21 and 28 years in prison. The district court granted a governmental motion for downward departure, and they arrived at this 17 and a half year sentence. However, if Mr. Whiteside had been sentenced just over a year later, he wouldn't have been sentenced as a career offender. And under a new interpretation of what qualified as a prior conviction, he would have not qualified as a career offender, and instead the guidelines would have recommended a roughly 14.5-year maximum sentence. And so if you assume the same proportionate downward departure, his ultimate sentence would have been 9 years and 4 months, which is a difference of about 8 years. And so the question is whether this difference in sentencing is something that can be cognizable under Section 2255 collateral review, which is just a really fancy way of saying, can you be resentenced after you've exhausted all your appeals in federal court based on this change in law that would have given you a different sentence?
So maybe give us a little context behind Mr. Whiteside's case. So he was in federal court after having had, you said, two felony convictions before, and those were in state court.
Yes. And so the question also is the interaction of state and federal crimes. And so under the guidelines, your state sentence qualifies you for the career offender enhancement if it could have been punishable by greater than a year in prison. And so the question here was whether if you take a categorical approach or if you take a particular approach, individualized to Mr. Whiteside's circumstances, which approach you should take in order to determine whether it was punishable by more than a year in prison. So originally the Fourth Circuit said if anyone could be sentenced to more than a year in prison for that crime, then it qualifies you for the career offender enhancement. Later they said only if you in your particular circumstances could have been sentenced to greater than a year in prison, and he could not have been based on his career or his criminal history at that time.
Okay, and so he was sentenced in 2010. In 2011, a panel of the Fourth Circuit, which is the appellate court, I guess, embracing where he was tried, came up with this ruling.
Exactly.
So, Kate, it seems like the unique contribution of your piece is this loss of chance analysis. Given how the guidelines work, there's a lot of discretion for judges, and so whether he was found to be a career offender or not, there's a chance that he might have gotten the same sentence. And it seems like your position is, well, even if the outcome might have been the same, the fact that it likely would have been different is something we should care a lot about. Can you explain a little bit what the loss of chance doctrine is and where it comes from and why you think it should apply here?
Sure. So loss of chance is actually a doctrine from tort, and it's most commonly used in medical malpractice. And so the idea in medical malpractice is if it was not more likely than not that you would have had a better outcome but for what actually happened, or but for your doctor's negligence, you can still recover. And so the idea is, if you, for example, had a 40% chance of recovery, and then your doctor negligently misdiagnosed you, let's say, and so now you have a 25% chance of recovery, that 15% difference in chance is something that matters to you. Even though we can't know for sure that you would have recovered otherwise, we know that you had some sort of loss and you could have had a different outcome. And so the law chooses to recognize that loss of chance as a legally cognizable harm. And so you can recover in tort for the percentage diminution in your recovery.
And it seems like the application of the loss of chance doctrine from tort to criminal sentencing may be a little challenging, though, because we recognize that medical cases are sort of random, right? There's mm-hmm. a chance and things might happen. Is sentencing really random in that same way, where we can construct some probability distribution of what your sentence might be if you were a career offender versus if you weren't?
Yeah, so this is the really interesting thing, I think, about the sentencing guidelines. So they used to be mandatory, right, until 2005.
Sorry, can you explain what that mm-hmm. is?
Absolutely. So to take you back to the beginning of time, so in the beginning we had judge-made law, right? And then in 1984, we had the Sentencing Reform Act, and liberals and conservatives came together and said there are problems with judges having complete discretion in sentencing, and we need to rein in that discretion because it's leading to disparities. Liberals were particularly concerned about racial biases that appeared to be cropping up in sentencing, and people of different races receiving wildly disparate sentences. And so the guidelines is like this giant matrix based on your criminal history and your offense category. And so the career offender enhancement here raises both your criminal history and your offense category. You look in this table, find criminal history, find offense category, boom, that in the past, what your sentence had to be within whatever the parameters were. So for example, like 210 to 262 months or whatever it is. Then in 2005, the Supreme Court struck down the mandatory guidelines and said now the guidelines are advisory because they severed and excised the parts that made them mandatory. And so the question is, under the advisory guidelines, can an error in sentencing, even something as great as the career offender error, which could lead to a difference of 10 years in your sentence, can that ever be a fundamental miscarriage of justice under collateral review standards if you could have received the same sentence again? So now, if you're a judge, you first step in sentencing is you calculate the guidelines recommended range. Second step is you determine the sentence. So you're supposed to take into account the guidelines, but you can't even presume under the law that the guidelines are reasonable. You also have to make this independent determination. So the question is, what is the continued role of the guidelines? Does it still play a role? And I'm arguing that it does. And there are a couple of reasons for that. The first reason is that empirically, if we look at the psychological anchoring effect, that, and I can talk more about that in a second, that seems to be borne out.
Sorry, maybe we can go back because I think it's maybe important to really lay out the sentencing framework. As you said, 1984, there's the institution of the guidelines. And mm-hmm. from 1984... Through 2006, they were basically, under federal law, they were mandatory. So the judge made these calculations based on the table, and that range that the guidelines recommended based on that table was mandatory. The judge had to sentence within that range. But in 2006, what happened?
So you have United States versus Booker, and the Supreme Court says the guidelines can no longer be mandatory because for them to be mandatory is a violation of the Sixth Amendment, because the judge is determining factors that matter for upward departure in your sentence without any sort of jury involvement. And so the guidelines can only be advisory.
And for our listeners, the Sixth Amendment guarantees that a jury should be able to try your criminal case if you're at jeopardy of your liberty.
And so since that point, there's been this question, how do we manage an advisory guideline system? And so the Supreme Court has said the point of the guidelines, the purpose of the guidelines, is for them to have an anchoring effect on judges. But the purpose is not to be the rigid system that it was before, where judges have to sentence within that. It should just be the initial starting point.
So how do judges sentence now after Booker?
So now, step one of judicial sentencing, judges receive a pre-sentence report, and that has a calculated guidelines recommended sentence based on this sentencing table. And step two, judges make an independent determination, taking into account the recommended guideline sentence, of what is going to be the sentence within the statutory minimum and maximum.
And do we actually find, sort of empirically, that judges take the guidelines very seriously or take the guidelines as basically mandatory? I mean, are they behaving differently than they did before Booker?
Yeah. So I think the best way to look at it is what judges are doing in terms of sentencing now. And so about 50% of sentences now are within guidelines range, and about 20% are within government-sponsored downward departures. So that means that you have 25 to 30% left that are outside of either guidelines range or government recommendations. And so that suggests that there is some sort of anchoring effect that continues. I think the other question that people have is whether judges themselves feel that they have this anchoring effect. And many judges report that they do, but some judges say, no, step two of the guidelines where you make an independent determination means what it says. I'm making an independent determination.
Yeah, it seems like your argument sort of breaks the fourth wall of American criminal procedure in assuming that the judge is a person with a psychology that can be affected by this sort of anchoring effect. And that's really interesting because, you know, I think a lot of people would say, look, in a sentencing hearing, it's a two-party adversarial hearing. Each side gets to make its arguments before the judge. And notwithstanding the guidelines calculation, the defense counsel can get up and say, look, we don't think that substantively looking at the factors that you're supposed to consider when you're setting a sentence, we don't think that substantively the guideline sentence reflects what is fair. The defense has the opportunity to present that argument. The defense has the opportunity to go to the guidelines and say, well, we actually don't think that the conduct of the defendant in this case rises to the level, you know, the guidelines puts the defendant's conduct in this bucket as just a matter of, you know, rigid sort of arithmetic. But we don't think that from a fairness perspective, it belongs there. So we're going to calculate the guidelines without that and present it to you. The defendant can do that. Mm-hmm. Why? What would you say in response to that?
So I would say, yes, that's absolutely true, obviously. And maybe what's happening is judges are independently determining. However, social psychology suggests that that's not the case. So there have been a lot of studies of the anchoring effect. And those studies have found that an initial number has an effect on the ultimate number that you give. And so studies involving judges in an experimental context, not obviously with actual defendants, have found a similar effect. And so a study of over 100 magistrate judges found that their sentencing was affected by an initial their determination of damages was affected by whether they heard a motion to dismiss on a $75,000 amount in controversy, which is the requirement for diversity jurisdiction in federal court. And so those who heard the motion to dismiss ended up with lower ultimate damages than those who did not. And then another study, and this is out of Germany, found that judges who knew that they were in an experimental setting, right, and they were trying to determine a sentence in a rape case when they rolled dice, even though they knew that they're just rolling dice and they know it's completely random, they end up with a sentence that's anchored to whatever they rolled on the dice. So those who were given loaded dice that always ended up with like three gave lower sentences than those who were given loaded dice that ended up with nine. And so we can infer that that is probably being borne out as well in this context.
So the guidelines is a loaded die.
Exactly.
So let's, I guess, assume that you're correct and the miscalculation under the sentencing guidelines has a strong enough effect that it's a real loss that the law should recognize. You know, one question I have is, what about the people who have already gotten out of jail? It seems like, just like the man that you mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, you know, had potentially lost 8 years of his life, someone else might lose several years of their lives, but now they just aren't in prison anymore, and so don't really have the standing to challenge their sentence under a collateral review.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So my article is only, or my comment, is only dealing with the fundamental miscarriage of justice standard for Section 2255 review. And so Section 2255 being part of the broader federal habeas. In habeas, we always think of the remedy as release, and there's not really a post-release remedy. I think the idea of guidelines error could lead one to the idea of compensating someone who's since gotten out of jail for that lost chance. Obviously, in federal court, that doesn't happen. Many states, you know, now have wrongful conviction statutes. Like North Carolina, I think you get paid $50,000 a year for every year that you were wrongfully incarcerated. And so you could imagine a similar sort of approach, much like tort, because you have the judge's duty to sentence correctly. The judge has breached that duty. You have the harm. You can determine damages. However, absolute judicial immunity and the Federal Tort Claims Act from fed courts suggests that that's not going to happen anytime soon at the federal level.
So walk us through how federal courts have been dealing with this issue. You mentioned the Fourth Circuit explicitly because of its applicability to Mr. Whiteside's case, but take us around the country.
Sure. So there are four courts that have directly confronted this issue: the Fourth Circuit, the Seventh Circuit, the Eighth Circuit, and the Eleventh Circuit. And the Seventh, Eighth, and Eleventh Circuits now, since I first wrote the comment, have all said that there is not cognizability here, that there is no fundamental miscarriage of justice. The Fourth Circuit panel said, yes, there is a fundamental miscarriage of justice. That opinion has since been reversed on other grounds, and so it's no longer...
Reversed
en banc on other grounds. The decisions in every single circuit have been single vote decisions. And in the 8th and 11th circuits, they've both been en banc decisions.
So this seems like a very contentious issue, all these en banc decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. And the First Circuit actually a few weeks ago recently declined to reach this issue more broadly than finding a fundamental miscarriage of justice in a specific factual context in which the state had vacated the underlying convictions because there was rampant falsification of drug samples at the office of the state that had already that had carried out the testing for the underlying state convictions.
So what do you think is going to happen next year? Is the Supreme Court likely to weigh in?
I don't know. I mean, I think after the marriage equality cert, one can never guess what the Supreme Court's going to do. I wonder if the fact that the 7th, 8th, and now 11th circuits have all gone in the same direction points to an emerging trend, or whether instead, as other circuits weigh in, there's going to be more of a split. And I think if there were a split, you know, of course there's a possibility the Supreme Court could weigh in.
What are you hoping the impact of this piece will be on this ongoing conversation among the courts and practitioners and judges and the broader community?
Yeah, so ideally, I'd like to think that people will think carefully about what constitutes harm in not just the sentencing context, but in the larger project of thinking about probabilistic reasoning in law more broadly. And so when we think about, for example, standing, one question that's emerged recently is whether loss of chance can be a concrete and particularized injury that's sufficiently actual or imminent that it leads to standing in federal court.
Can you just explain quickly what standing
absolutely.
Is?
So standing is basically your ability to bring a claim in federal court under Article 3. And it means that you have an actual case or controversy. And so recently in 2013, there was this decision, Clapper versus Amnesty International, in which Justice Breyer in dissent talked about probabilistic reasoning, not using the phrase loss of chance, but essentially the idea of loss of chance, and saying that was sufficient for standing. Justice Alito and the majority differed with that by saying what was at issue was a highly attenuated chain of causal events that was insufficient. And so I think this is another sort of another take on what constitutes harm. More particularly in sentencing, though, I would hope that this is a way to sort of break out of the fairness and finality divide that shapes how we talk about sentencing and how we talk about challenging sentencing on collateral review after all your appeals have been exhausted. And so one way of thinking about it that many courts have adopted is either it's about fairness to the individual defendant or it's about finality and the interests of the criminal system in having these convictions sort of rest in peace. And that has a couple of dimensions, victims' rights, and also not wanting to open floodgates. And so I think one thing courts have struggled with is how you can think of something where statutorily you could have the same thing happen again ever be something that constitutes a fundamental miscarriage of justice. And so this is a way to think about that. And it's also saying that, look, this is what courts are already debating because throughout these opinions from the 4th, 7th, 8th, and 11th circuits, the judges on each side, judges who favor cognizability, are saying this is all about you would almost certainly get a different sentence. Judges who don't are saying, no, there's no possibility of a different sentence, statutory minimum, statutory maximum, but they're not really engaging with each other. So even if the idea of loss of chance isn't adopted, I would hope this is a way for like both sides to have some sort of common language to talk about whether that loss of chance matters and to recognize that that's really the grounds of the disagreement.
We got a chance to catch up with Yale Law School professor Fiona Doherty. She teaches the clinic in criminal justice here, and she teaches a seminar in sentencing. We asked her about her thoughts on the piece.
I think Kate is absolutely correct that the guidelines have a clear anchoring effect. When you look at how many cases result in guideline sentences, it's between 70 and 80%. So the anchoring effect is arguably much stronger than even Kate points out in this piece. And there's no doubt, I don't think anyone doubts, that if this man, Mr. Whiteside, was brought back for a sentencing proceeding in federal court, he would get a much lower sentence than he received. The estimate is that he would actually get 8 years of his life back. And that's because the guideline range is, in effect, kind of a ceiling in the federal sentencing process. Prosecutors never really ask, in a very, very tiny number of cases, do prosecutors ask for a sentence above the guideline range. Almost uniformly, they ask for a sentence within the range or perhaps a lower sentence because of a government-sponsored departure. So in effect, that would have been kind of the ceiling. He got way above the new, what would in effect now be his new ceiling, even without taking into account the effect of the government-sponsored departure. In other words, he would, in all likelihood, get at least 8 years of his life back. When you look at the dissent in Whiteside's case, it is in very strong language. The dissent accuses the majority in the en banc rehearing of letting a gross injustice happen on their watch, of basically refusing to do the easy work of giving a man back 8 years of his life when everyone agrees, even the majority, that a clear mistake was made and that under current law, the same sentence, the same guideline range would just not have been applied. But the truth is, with the amendments in the resentencing laws, judges actually have very little procedural room to fix mistakes in their sentences. It used to be, before the Sentencing Reform Act of 1984, that judges could fix an illegal sentence at any time. Just the parties could bring a motion, and of course both sides would weigh in and the judge could act. With the Sentencing Reform Act of 1984, that power was taken away, and I think Kate's article really highlights not discussed frequently, but real problem in the federal sentencing system where the law evolves, but people who were sentenced in years past don't get the benefit of that evolution.
That is, I think, a lovely note to wrap up on. Thanks so much to Kate and Fiona for joining us. I feel like I've learned so much today.
Yes, very interesting.
So
thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us. A few more people to credit: Ryan McAvoy and the Yale Broadcast Center, Jack Baglin for the music, and the Yale Law Journal for its support.